families that feud. Most everybody in this room could probably get up here and preach something about families that feud. Everybody has a family that have bones somewhere buried away. It's something I've learned over the years, especially with the amount of premarital counseling that I do with couples, college students, and then we talk about their families, and everybody's got something. Families just feud, and from those family feuds of some kind, there's been deep scars that have been left. But from those scars, I mean, scarring is strengthening, and so a family's been strengthened because of something that happened that has now been reconciled, and there's kind of a scar there that has strengthened them around that thing. Yet on others, the cut's just as deep as it always has been, and maybe it's been cut deeper, and someone's come along the way and thrown gasoline on the cut, and it's still something that's messy, and people lose sleep over. A couple of years ago, when I was asked to fill for a Sunday when Donnie was gone, I was asked to talk about overcoming rejection. And some of you probably remember the Sunday that Barry stood up here and just cried all over you. And family feuds hurt. They probably hurt worse than conflicts with others, conflicts at work, social conflicts, just because they just don't go away unless they're dealt with. You can change jobs, you can change circles of friends, but your family is your family. I mean, you can try to run away from it, but that's still, the blood's still there. And I still wrestle. I wrestle with the struggles in my family, because there is a definite split in my family that is very clear. And I'm not really one, I'm not in the party of one side or the other. I'm kind of one of those that's just in the middle of it. But people very close to me don't speak to one another, and they don't get together on holidays. However, when it comes holiday time for me, I have a really hard time making the decision. Where do I go at Christmas? Who do I give priority to? And I'm married, and so I've also got in-laws to think about in this, and yet my family goes two different directions, and it makes it even more complicated. And then birthdays for my children come around. And I wrestle with, do I invite my whole family? Knowing that somebody's not going to show up because they don't want to see somebody else, and then I'm just going to be ticked. And then my children are going to be hurt because somebody didn't show up. Or do we just invite this small portion of the family because, well, we know that they'll get along, it'll be okay, and we'll all be happy, and we won't have to worry about the stress that's there, and we can kind of feel like we're at peace. Or do I invite everybody, and everybody does show up, and then something stupid happens, and then my children are hurt, and I'm frustrated. I mean, I think that there's probably some of you in the room that relate to that a little bit, and I'm probably not alone in that emotion. About a year and a half ago, my stepmother passed away, and it was a difficult time for myself and for my father. My mother passed away when I was 13. My dad was married to my mom for 19 years. My dad was married to my stepmother for 19 years. And going through that again, it was tough. But you know, in the days leading up to and the day of the funeral, I don't think I mourned and had nearly as much emotion as I did in the evening after, in the next several days after the funeral. Because leading up to the funeral, I got a letter from somebody in my family that simply said, I hope you know that I love you, and I'm sorry that this has happened, but please understand, I can't be there. I couldn't understand that. why can't you come support me just because I've been to funerals for you of people I didn't really know, just knowing that you needed to be, and so I'm ticked. And then I realized afterwards how many people that I think I'm very close to in my family who live very close to where this funeral happened, who didn't even bother to show up or even call me and support me in a really difficult time. And I was deeply, deeply hurt on that. And it all goes back to something that happened 20 years ago. I'm sure I'm not alone in that, but the reality is that when we're talking about families that feud, family feuds affect so much more than the feuders, much more easily. Weddings, I feel like, sometimes bring out the worst in families. maybe one of the more stressful things that a pastor gets asked to do sometimes is try to help navigate weddings. and navigate opinions and navigate difficult family feuds that present themselves, and everybody comes together for what's supposed to be a happy occasion, and yet the bride and groom are left the night before the wedding in tears because somebody didn't show up to the rehearsal, or something happened, or a part of the family's not coming. And some of you probably followed myself and Gavin on our Californian trip here recently. Gavin and I went out to a wedding in Simi Valley and had a wonderful time going out there, but it was awful sad the night after the rehearsal dinner. I mean, this has happened a few times, and I'm standing out in the front lawn with the couple. We're just talking, and Jeff turned to me and said, "It's awful interesting how much it seems that our wedding has to do with everybody else and not so much with us." And on some level, I thought, didn't anybody ever tell you that? Man, that's like every single time seems like that. I started my premarital counseling with that. Your wedding will appear like it means so much more to everybody else than it does you. It's not true, but it's going to appear that way. But, you know, there was a cousin in this family that was just hacked, that her cousin was getting married before her when she'd been dating this guy for 7 years and their wedding wasn't going to happen for another year. And yet Shannon and Jeff met and they've been together for 18 months and now they're getting married and she's just getting married to beat me to the altar. And so a mom or an aunt and a cousin and other people in a family were not going to come to the ceremony because of this. And they were devastated. And so now a bride and groom are hurt and the parents of those are hurt. And cousins and nephews and nieces are hurt. Today's text is a similar family conflict. I mean, I think on some of these stories, I've touched on some emotions with some of y'all. That's why I did so many of those. Family feuds hurt, and they hurt more than just those who feud. And when cuts aren't cared for, they can be cut deeper, gasoline's thrown on. And in today's text, it's something like that. Something that starts out of pride and terrible actions out of that pride, like Donnie illustrated last week, leads to a family being divided and hurt. And some of the hurt, I don't even think we get to see in the text. We could probably assume is there. And we're going to talk about the family of Abraham today. You know, Father Abraham, he had many sons. You know, we know that song, "We Wave Our Arms and March Around." Initially, he had two sons, though, right? Well, he had no sons when it all started out. But we kind of know the story. Just going to kind of try to run through it here. Abraham, he's given a promise in chapter 12 of the book of Genesis, verses 1 through 3. And that text is on the screen for you. The Lord said to Abraham, or Abram, actually, before his name changes later, of course, "Go from your country, your people, and your father's household to the land I will show you. I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse, and all peoples on earth will be blessed through you." Abraham's about 75 years old at this time. And he and Sarah had no children. Of course, the name's Sarai at the time. It changes later, of course, too. Make it simple, I'm just going to call them Abraham and Sarah, okay? And it appeared that they weren't going to be able to have children. At that age, they'd been trying quite a long time, and nothing had happened. So how in the world is there going to be a great nation out of this couple? How in the world are they going to have a great name when it's just going to die away in a few years? How are they going to be a blessing to all peoples on earth when they're going to disappear fairly soon? It seems impossible, if not for God. That's probably key. And we know the story continues in Genesis 15, 5 through 6. It says, "He, God, took him, Abraham, outside and said, 'Look up at the heavens and count the stars, if indeed you can count them.' And then he said to him, 'So shall your offspring be.' Abram believed the Lord, and he credited it to him as righteousness." This was God's answer to Abraham. When Abraham had questions of God about having descendants, of how in the world is this possible? At my age, my wife's age, we've never had children. It seems like that's just not possible. So what's the solution? What's the other option? And God, again, gives him a promise. In Genesis 16, Abraham's now 85 or 86 years old, and Sarah says, "You know, there sure ain't no baby coming for me, so let's try it another way. Here's my servant Hagar. Do what you need to so we can have a child." and enters Hagar. Abraham agrees to the arrangement. Now, on the surface, it sounds like, wow, what a cruddy husband. what a terrible, terrible idea. Well, we got to kind of keep in mind context on this, because this happening was perfectly right within their culture. This is not something that they just dreamed up on their own. There was a practice for this, and there was a way to protect the family and protect their possessions that they didn't, and they didn't have the written law of God yet, okay? They're going on what God has told them so far. And we also got to keep in mind they don't necessarily come from what we would think of as a Jewish family. Now the line leads through there, but the family they come from was a polytheistic family. They worshiped things that they had gods from the forces of nature that they worshiped. And so this calling of God to Abraham and for him to be obedient to it is pretty incredible for one, but on some level could have initially just been one of the many who might have been calling on him to do something. And it's later that he kind of understands, I believe, that there is just this one, this is the God that I am to follow. But they don't have the foundation and background that we might have when we're reading this story and really want to cast a whole lot of judgment upon. They haven't been told you're supposed to get rid of all your idols yet. They haven't been told what all the laws of the land are, and that actually the laws of the land might not necessarily be beneficial for them, that the law of God is better. There's a legal code at the time that in Abraham or Sarah's case was okay for the wife who could not have children to allow one of her servants to have children for her. If she could not, this was part of it. And so they take this substitutionary way to try to help protect the family possessions on some level and maybe try to fulfill what they think they're being told to do, even though it's not what they were told to do. So I don't want to completely take it away from them, but I also want us to try to understand the context of what they were living in as best that we can. So the initial shock of the story of what a terrible idea, Abraham and Sarah, you idiots, I think we could be fooled a little bit too sometimes when our biblical beliefs and cultural convictions clash. Abraham, he has the moment with Hagar. A child is conceived and born, and they name him Ishmael. We fast forward the story about 13 years. Abraham's now 99, his wife Sarah's 90, and God speaks to Abraham again in Genesis 17, and God tells him that Sarah will birth a son. They don't have to find some other way to do it. What they did before was not what he was planning. She will birth a son. Now, I think about this a little bit, and Sarah still might want it to be another way. Maybe not. I mean, there is that identity thing there, but, you know, Christy and I just had our third son. And Christy didn't necessarily bounce back all as quickly as she did when she was in her early 20s with our first son. and thinking about this thing being much later in life, that woman was a warrior. I tell you what. All right, so a year later, it's recorded, Genesis 21, 1 through 7, Sarah conceives, gives birth to a son, and they name him Isaac. And that finally gets us to our text that I've been assigned for today. Verses 8 through 21 in the book of Genesis. Naturally, the situation we're in doesn't sound very good. I mean, it just sounds like this is a recipe for conflict and problems. Here's the rest of the story, as Paul Harvey would say, I guess. Verse 8, the child grew and was weaned, and on the day Isaac was weaned, Abraham held a great feast. But Sarah saw that the son whom Hagar the Egyptian had bore to Abraham was mocking. And she said to Abraham, get rid of that slave woman and her son, for that slave woman's son will never share in the inheritance with my son Isaac. The matter distressed Abraham greatly because it concerned his son. But God said to him, do not be distressed about the boy or your maidservant. Listen to whatever Sarah tells you, because it is through Isaac that your offspring will be reckoned. I will make the son of the maidservant into a nation also, because he is your offspring. Early the next morning, Abraham took some food and a skin of water and gave them to Hagar. He set them on her shoulders and then sent her off with the boy. She went on her way and wandered into the desert of Beersheba. When the water was in the skin was gone, she put the boy under one of the bushes, and then she went off and sat down nearby, about a bow shot away, for she thought, I cannot watch the boy die. And as she sat there nearby, she began to sob. God heard the boy crying, and the angel of God called to Hagar from heaven and said to her, "What is the matter, Hagar? Do not be afraid. God has heard the boy crying as he lies there. Lift the boy up and take him by the hand, for I will make him into a great nation." And then God opened her eyes, and she saw a well of water. So she went and filled the skin with water and gave the boy a drink. God was with the boy as he grew up. He lived in the desert and became an archer. While he was living in the desert of Paran, his mother got a wife for him from Egypt. There's not a lot of resolve necessarily to the story, other than they just kind of split and parted ways. And in verse 9, we can almost, just from reading this portion, kind of point our finger at the punk teenager kid who was being a punk teenager kid, probably. And something that this proud new mother in her 90s was in no mood for his attitude at this feast for her son and for their family. And who knows what all was really going on in that time, but there's something there. But we have to ask the question of, what is the root of this problem? What is the root of the family? Where's the feud really at? Where's the conflict really at? You know, whose fault is it? Is it Ishmael's fault for being a punk teenager at this celebration for his new half-brother? Is it Hagar's fault for something that's not recorded? Is it Abraham's fault for not being a better leader of his family, not being more obedient to what God had told him to do? Is it Sarah's fault for kind of starting the whole idea in the first place and planning the idea of, well, let's just go around the whole plan? And we could heap blame on everybody here. I think Sarah was probably frustrated, as would make sense. There's frustration when you can't conceive. I get that. I've heard that story many times, and that's a hard thing. And it's easy to want to try to put blame in other places. And then at the point that Abraham is able to actually sleep with Hagar and conceive a child, that's pretty obvious who's the one that has the problems. And Sarah, you're the one that physically can't do this. I'm sure there was a lot of problems and a lot of pride hurt. We get back to that pride thing. And it seems to be a huge distress. And so they find any way to try to find an answer to this thing about their family and there being a way to carry on the family name. And again, I think when it comes down to it, the root of the problem is pride within people, specifically was probably within Abraham and Sarah. Out of that pride for either wanting just, I'm not who I think I am until I have a child, or out of the pride of I got to protect my family name and my family possessions or whatever it is, a family is ripped apart and everybody's affected. Everybody listed in the story, and keep in mind, there's more people involved in this family of Abraham, other servants and things like that in the company of the family of Abraham than just the people we have in our story as well. And people you're close to, people you eat with, people you spend holidays with year-round are all of a sudden, those relationships are severed and everybody is suffering the consequences of it. And that's the case, I think, in family feuds. They affect far more than the feuders. The application, though, to this whole thing, there's not much there in the story itself. The application here, you know, what's the resolve? And what do we do with that story when we leave this place? And to bring an answer to that, I kind of want us to jump into the book of James just a little bit. There's some powerful words in the third chapter of James that I think translate very well to this conflict for us to understand how we should respond in similar situations, or maybe in this specific situation, which I'll talk about in a moment. James 3, verses 13 through 18. Where James is writing to Christians who are trying to figure out how to live amongst the hostile world that they're living under. They're Jews who are now Christ followers that are living amongst other Jews and other Gentiles who are hostile towards their belief and their worldview. How are you supposed to live within that conflict, within your families that want to be at each other because you say Jesus is the way and they say no way? Or between the Gentiles that are around you that seem to think that you're not really following order, that you ought to be bowing to the throne of Caesar rather than the throne of Jesus. How do you live in that culture? How do you live with that split? James writes this, verse 13, "Who is wise and understanding among you? Let him show it by his good life, by deeds done and the humility that comes from wisdom. But if you harbor bitter envy and selfish ambition in your heart, do not boast about it or deny the truth. Such wisdom does not come down from heaven, but is earthly, unspiritual, of the devil. For where you have envy and selfish ambition, there you find disorder and every evil practice." Verse 17, "But the wisdom that comes from heaven is first of all pure, then peace-loving, considerate, submissive, full of mercy and good fruit, impartial and sincere. Peacemakers who sow in peace raise a harvest of righteousness." I read that text in remembrance of the story of the family of Abraham. I don't think I would say that there was the kind of wisdom that James is talking about that should be had when dealing with this conflict, this unresolved stuff. I don't think in the story from Genesis 21 we see much peace-loving, people being considerate of one another, of being submissive to one another, of mercy being shown, of good fruit, of being impartial. And he said, "Well, Barry, it says that God told Abraham to do whatever Sarah said, but we don't necessarily know why. Maybe she was supposed to go because if she stayed, something worse was going to happen. Because what was so hard in Sarah's heart maybe was something that was brewing to be something worse. What's worse, that they're separated and sent off into the wilderness to survive on their own and become a great family themselves, or for them to be tortured within the family? And who knows, we've seen stories in the Bible where things in family conflict lead to somebody's death. I don't know what would happen if they had stayed, but I do know what happened initially wasn't right. That there was something out of pride and misguided steps that happened to create this whole problem in the first place. And I don't think the problem was then addressed with wisdom that's being described here. James' instructions for Christ followers is to be peacemakers. It's a really good translation of the verb noun Greek word that is put here. To be peacemakers. It's not just being peaceful people, but being peacemakers. It's that idea of, it's not the idea of kind of withdrawing and trying to not cause ruffles. It's actually engaging, causing there to be peace. You have to do something about it to cause peace to happen, not just be peaceful yourself and reserve to a cave and let the rest of the world go on around you. It's being active in the making of peace. Sarah's anger and Abraham's response, I don't think there's a cause to be peacemakers here. It seemed more of an avoidance and Sarah wanting to avoid the conflict and avoid the glares. And who knows what kind of spiteful things were going on under the surface. We know there were some things going back and forth with the language that's used in the previous chapters, but still, I think it's something that is rooted in their pride and unable to deal with it. It's kind of what happened in my family. 20 years ago, something happens, and now we just try to avoid each other so we can feel like there's some peace, but there really isn't. There's still a ton of unrest. For some reason, we have this desire to just try to divorce situations as if they just kind of go away, and sometimes they do, but most of the time, especially in family conflict, it doesn't. It just prolongs the distress. And at some level, I think we could probably stop right here. And I could just say, you know, these words from James, when we're thinking about conflict, especially in our family, it ought to be wise to read them whenever we're facing something and think about this. Am I approaching this in a wise way? Or is my own bitterness and envy and my own evil intentions really playing in here? How can I be a peacemaker in my family? And that's really where I thought this sermon was going until Friday. And a whole other thing just landed on me while I'm sitting in McDonald's. You know, it's where all the spiritual stuff happens in town. That this family feud, this particular family feud that we read about affects all of us. We are still part of it, even today. If you were a follower of Jesus Christ, then you are part of Abraham's family, or Abraham's seed and heirs according to the promise. But that language sounds familiar. If you are a follower of Jesus Christ, you are part of the family of Abraham. And so this is your family that has a many centuries old feud where a family is split. And the way I see it, that feud isn't over. Now I realize what I'm going to share, and when I share this, you're going to say, good grief, does this guy talk about anything else? Not really, no. I realize there's not 100% proof for this, and we are following what the majority believe to be true and what is being said about this family, but here's the thing. For the most part, in general, it is believed that the founder of Islam, Muhammad, came directly from the family line of Ishmael. He claimed that to be the case. There's many that make that claim. It's not 100% across the board, but that's generally believed that the root of Islam traces its way all the way back to the family of Abraham at this split. Even though knowing that he said what was revealed to him in a cave, you know, it was hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years later, we can trace the family all the way back. If that is the case, let's just say if that is the case, then here's a big question. Within our culture, what kind of wisdom are we seeking in our relationships to Muslims? Are we harboring bitterness, envy, and selfish ambition? Or are we expressing peace-loving relationships? We're being considerate, showing mercy, being impartial. I would guess that our default as American Christians is not. Our default isn't to be peace-loving. There's so much anger present due to actions of radical things happening around the world and even in our own country that it makes us paint the whole nation of Islam with a broad stroke. And so whenever we come in contact, there's that thing of wanting to avoid or just be bitter towards. And our nationalism kicks in before the fruit of the Spirit kicks in. The thing I was challenged with on Friday was that these words of James charged to Christians in the first century is also a charge for us to consider today as Christians towards the nation of Islam. That we as followers of Jesus are not simply to be peaceful, but strive to be peacemakers with them, with the Muslims among us. And I don't know if you realize it or not, I would think that you got to if you have eyes and you get out in the community at all, but we live in a growing Muslim community. In 2 years, just students from Saudi Arabia at Western doubled, more than doubled, in just 2 years. I'm not even sure what the numbers are going to be this year, but I understand it's probably going to be larger because the nation of Saudi Arabia is trying to send between 2013 and 2020, 75,000 Saudi Arabian students to the United States to go to school. That's why the population is just growing across the country. It's grown over 40% in the last 2 years across the country. And I don't even know what this coming school year's numbers are. I asked Dana in the Center for National Studies for them. She didn't have them ready yet. It won't be till after the semester starts, as I thought. But we are in a growing Muslim community, not just in students, but professors as well. And are we taking seriously how to be peacemakers in this ongoing family feud that still presents itself today? And I'm not just talking about being friendly with Muslims, but striving to be peacemakers. Dave Ramsey quotes at the very end of every single radio show, there's ultimately only one way to financial peace. It's to walk daily with the Prince of Peace, Christ Jesus. Maybe I'm the only one that listens to that in the afternoon. But anyway, I figured Bruce would just throw that out there. Ultimately, there's only one way to bring about peace to a multi-century family feud is to help everybody to walk daily with the Prince of Peace, Christ Jesus. I think Jesus died for them too. We sang a song when we were beginning here this morning of how he loves us. We're not talking about God's love just for Christians. He loves all people. All were created in him. And he wants them. They may not like what everybody does, but he loves all people. By his wounds we are healed. We sang that this morning. Those wounds are in all people and can be healed by the blood of Jesus, even Muslim people. And I want to challenge you to commit to praying a dangerous prayer. And I've prayed this prayer and it's been answered. I'm praying it again. And I think it'll be answered again. But Keisha, you throw that up there. Some version of this. God, would you bless me with the opportunity to build a friendship with a Muslim so I might be used by you to be an instrument of peace between them and your son, Jesus Christ. Amen. Or something like that, of course. And the reason I think that's a dangerous prayer is because in a community that we live in, I think that prayer will be answered probably much more quickly than you really thought. Because if you're praying that prayer regularly, I think your eyes are going to be open to the opportunity that probably present themselves in and around this community. And you're going to realize that those opportunities have been around you the whole time. And when you used to kind of walk around people, you won't necessarily walk around them anymore. And when somebody's sitting at a bus stop at Walmart, you won't just walk right past them anymore. If nothing else, I might ask you to pray for me and a student that I'm meeting with or I've been talking with from Qatar who just got here last semester. Probably the first Christian you ever met. And right now, we're just trying to get to know each other. But the fearful thing, I think, for most Christians is that to pray that prayer and for that prayer to be answered is then, now what do I do? Because I recognize there's Muslims around me. I recognize they're coming to our country very, very quickly, and I have an opportunity to impact kind of the globe in the Muslim nation. But what do I do? Because I don't understand their beliefs very well. I've heard some things, but I don't know what to do. I'm going to make one suggestion. There's multiple things you could do, but there is a really, really good 6-lesson curriculum that's been put together by Crescent Project. And Fahd Masri is the president of Crescent Project, and he's helped put together this curriculum called Bridges, Christians Connecting with Muslims. Really, really good stuff. Help you understand. He said the biggest question that most Muslims have is that, you know, the Bible is just a corrupt collection of books, that the people through the years have just corrupted what truth really was there, and they're the ones that have found answers to it, and help them understand that the Bible always has been. I mean, it hasn't been changed. These words are the ones that were always there. And he said, if you can help them answer that question, that helps answer the deepest struggle that they have with understanding Christianity. The curriculum is just really good. I just encourage you as individuals or maybe as your small groups to meet in homes or something to consider picking this up. Lifeway puts it out, and go online and find it somewhere, or I'm sure you got resources here through the church to maybe make that happen. And just spend some time in that and become equipped so that when God does answer that opportunity for you, the door is open, you're well prepared for the next steps to take. And just final thought. There was a time that there was an empire that was hostile towards followers of Jesus. They took ways to imprison them, run them out of towns, kill them, make laws to make it illegal to be followers of Jesus and to assemble together and to worship anything. And then, one by one, those Christ followers at the time, by being active and connecting people with the Prince of Peace, Christ Jesus, and they became believers and became followers themselves, and one by one, eventually the entire Roman Empire was not just accepting but converted. At least in a leadership standpoint. Why couldn't that happen again? To any nation, maybe physical nation or just religious nation, like the nation of Islam. Now, it sounds like a huge task, but really, it's just something that happens one at a time. And one at a time, and one at a time. And I encourage you to just think seriously about your relationship today. This ongoing family feud that we all still participate in is, as a Christ follower, what difference can you make in that? And I just hope you'll pray that prayer more than once. And when the opportunity presents itself, you'll boldly accept it. And I know you'll be incredibly blessed from that. This morning, that's my challenge. For you to take that with you. For others, though, you're not ready for it. There's a commercial that was a long time ago about, it was a kind of a PSA, an after-school kind of PSA, and I can't remember when it was shown or what network, but it was a picture of a kid standing on a dock looking down at their friend in the lake, and they were drowning. And they were drowning, and they were drowning, and they were drowning. And they just let them drown. Like, they had nothing, they couldn't reach down and grab them, they had no life preserver, they had nothing, and they just weren't equipped to do anything about it. Some of you are there because you still have a hole in your heart that needs to be filled by Jesus. And so everything I just talked about, that's not really in your playbook yet, and I realize that. You need to do something about that Jesus-sized hole that only he can fill. So this morning, that's an answer that you can give. That's something that you can do. That's something you can submit to. And then from that point, begin learning and growing and becoming disciples of Jesus that are able to teach others, including Muslim people, about the peacemaking love of Jesus Christ.